My name's Heiko Koo. I've been a Marxist speaker at Speaker's Corner since the end of 1985. Actually, the first thing I spoke about in 85 was a protest movement in France, and I was just about to leave to France to go and spend time there and join the protests and so on. So I'd been there. I'd just come back from these, and then I spoke here in London, and then went up to France and spent a few months there during those protests. I used to run a radio show in London called the Speaker's Corner Radio Show on Resonance FM, but during the lockdown period, they began to get complaints to Ofcom about my show, and then I'm not sure if it was that reason or if it was that they didn't approve of what I was saying. But since that time, they've cut me off and I've never been allowed back on. I've also been a journalist with the Chinese media. But anyway, that's...
Just tell us about your... What is the attraction of Speaker's Corner? Because for most people, it's just something... It's a bit of a laugh. It's somewhere that, you know, maybe tourists like to go along and see as part of the tourist trail as they visit London. Maybe sometimes Londoners, for a bit of a laugh, might want to go along. What's it... But anyway, how did you get to the point where you thought, listen, I'm going to actually get up there and start talking?
I'd been doing political protests, like on issues. So at the time, there was the Youth Trade Union Rights Campaign, where we were fighting against the sort of conscription of young people into labour service instead of unemployment by Margaret Thatcher at the time. And we organised a number of events, but then I was very keen on doing stuff in the open air, appealing to people rather than just selling newspapers or asking people to sign petitions. I thought you should be able to address people and talk to people and gather a crowd and speak to them. So we did that. We eventually found a formula for doing that in a pedestrian high street in Portsmouth, and found a way on Saturday afternoon when masses of people are passing by to stop them and get their attention and then suddenly gather a crowd. And one of the things that we did was, actually, I looked at a film, or I saw a film about the Wobblies in America, the IWW, which was called the International Workers of the World. And they would go from town to town in America, and they would try and unionize the towns, and they would stand up and speak, and then they would get arrested. And when one was arrested, then the next would get up. And when one was arrested, the next would get up, and that would cause chaos. And so we tried to apply exactly the same thing, because the police kept coming and stopping us from speaking in Portsmouth. Once we actually started gathering the crowd and had a formula for doing that, then the police tried to stop us. And so we did exactly this one day. We had a group of us who were, one would get stopped by the police, and the next would get up, and one would get stopped by the police, and the next would get up. So all three of us got arrested, basically, and spent 24 hours in the nick. And were charged for breach of the peace, but all the costs went against the police. And then when I moved back to London, I'd been at university or polytechnic in Portsmouth, then I naturally gravitated towards Speaker's Corner. There is that attitude that you describe, and there is also, I remember my ex, when I was about that age, 17, 16 years of age, from 17, I was going to school, and it was in early 20s, and her mother used to say, you're a bit like our Uncle Tom. He used to get up at Speaker's Corner. So if you had a point of view, you know, you were supposed to get up at Speaker's Corner and say it, and that's the sort of outlook in London amongst the working classes. It was always that. And I found that quite attractive and quite interesting, and I did that, you know. And I was also very keen on, I'd been taken by my mother to see Brecht's theatre, and I was very impressed by that, you know, a way of getting an idea across to people. So that's, if you've got a bug that makes you want to get up and speak about something, and you feel strongly about something, I'm very much a proponent of Speaker's Corner, precisely because it has that variety of views and the opportunity for you to address people.
Well, look, hang on, because this is something which most people would be rather nervous to do, because it's not like you're sitting on the TV, you've got a camera pointing at you and you can just waffle away. You've got a big crowd around you, some of who are going to be hostile. You're going to be barracked.
Yeah, I mean, there used to be a tradition in the British Labour movement and in Labour movement internationally, which I was referring to, where you would stand up on the street corner and speak. And that wasn't just the Labour movement, by the way. Tories used to stand up on the street corner and speak. I remember John Major. It was said that he won the election because of his soapbox performance, not because he did well on the soapbox, but because while Neil Kinnock stood up in a Sheffield Stadium doing a hoorah American Democrat style election campaign, John Major, man from the street, stood up on a soapbox and was heckled by people. And it is true you get heckled, and it is true you get harassed, and people argue against you. But it's that back and forth that strengthens your ability to communicate with people and to get your message across. So it's a training ground for reality, you know, the reality of the clash of ideas.
Well, before the mass media, or certainly before television and radio, you see pictures, even, you know, Victorian black and white pictures and stuff of MPs before the general election getting up in public and giving speeches exactly in that sort of situation where the public can throw questions back at them, don't you?
Yes, and that, in essence, it's no less powerful as a force than the internet or the radio or the television, ultimately, because the direct appearance of someone in front of you saying something is much more likely to convince someone and be able to convince someone. Let's say you're forming a group or an organization, a campaign, and to spread a message. The word of mouth is a tremendously powerful mechanism for spreading internationally, spreading nationally and internationally, a body of ideas. Otherwise, you know, you couldn't have had things like the 1848 revolutions, for example, spreading from country to country when there were only six telegraph stations in the whole of the world or the whole of Europe. So this was spread by word of mouth. And word of mouth, I was in East Germany at the time of the East German revolution. That was almost entirely word of mouth. And I remember, the days before, like the days before the 7th of October, when the mood changed in Berlin, it was all word of mouth. Everyone was in an excited state, and they'd just start discussing with each other in cafes and bars and restaurants, and everyone would just start talking to each other.
So, yeah, I mean, it does seem as if the political debate has been corralled to such an extent that many people in this country are, you know, that they've forgotten many of their even just post-war Labour roots. And it's kind of atomised society and depoliticised it by sticking it all in the box called the television.
Yeah, there's a delusion. Of course, it reinforces the idea that the people who are presented to you are somehow the real representatives of the views of the people. And of course, we've encountered that with Brexit and with multiple other issues, that the people aren't actually on board with the official narratives. But of course, you know, they made out Brexit and anti-Brexit as like these two institutional movements. But at the same time, it's the stuffing it to authorities that was the essence of what happened there. And I think that is also a manifestation of an underlying discontent that can brew up within a population that challenges all the stories and narratives that they're being told.
Now, Kees van der Peil, he's put a couple of books out looking at the what he describes as a power grab by the financial elite in the West. His attitude is, well, they know that there's going to be a backlash, and so they want to control that backlash. They want to occupy that backlash and start to control both sides of the chessboard. So what do you make of that?
I think there's validity to that, and I do think that's been the case in the last few years in particular, that you've had a number of campaigns that are, you could call them orchestrated or fake campaigns, you know, where you suddenly have groups of people appearing with, in the classic, I mean, I did read a book once, I remember, by Saul Alinsky, and this was from the early 1970s, and he was trying to institutionalize some of the countercultural movement in the United States and spread his message around the world. And the way to do that was a whole series of campaigning tactics and marketing tactics that they use. And eventually this ended up within the ambit and game plans of the elites, and they began to finance things, you know, have a single coloured flag. Everyone gets together around a couple of issues, find a prominent person who you're going to declare to be the leader, you know, have a certain set of slogans that you raise and promote, you know, all of which is a reasonable method for campaigning or marketing. So it's the capitalization, if you like, of campaigning. Now, that doesn't mean that all those campaigns are necessarily false campaigns. And it doesn't necessarily mean that all those campaigns are actually will permanently be controlled or are controlled. But it means they can become controlled under certain circumstances in sufficiently to sway them in one direction, perhaps at a decisive moment. You know, revolutions and counter-revolutions are often swayed by a sudden and dramatic moment when an opportunity exists to do something or an opportunity exists not to do something, you know. And so so I guess that's that game plan, you know. You're playing a type of game of chess, you know, and you need to know the moves you can make. You need to have rehearsed
The book's called States of Emergency.
Okay.
He's got another one called The Pandemic of Angst, yeah. Which is about keeping people nervous. I think it's great. Keeping the Global Population in Check is States of Emergency is subtitled. And I think there's very few academics who really seem to have got their head around this. But he's ex-Sussex University. Uh-huh. I think he's been booted out for alleged anti-Semitism or something.
Oh, I saw a video. I think you sent me a link to a video of his.
Could possibly have done.
Yeah,
anyway, you know, it's interesting that a lot of your start at Speaker's Corner was connected with the French, because over the channel they do seem to have a kind of different attitude to all of this. Why do you think that is?
There is a different historical tradition. One, because of the revolutionary background, there was 70, you know, there's a whole wave of revolutionary historical events that have involved the masses and that have reshaped the dynamics of politics in France. So 1789, 1830, 1848, 1871, just before the First World War, just after the First World War, 1936, 1945, 1968, and some others since that time as well, that have been mass movements that suddenly galvanized the population around political issues or social issues. And when they come together, they suddenly reformulate their concept of what they are as a people. You know, it's the movement of the people itself that makes the movement, not the specific issue on which it was mobilized. So for whatever reason, France, perhaps it started its revolution before the French Revolution, before it was able really to establish capitalism. So it all became forces in play and in battle with each other, where they bashed out their ideas. I mean, to some degree, that was also the case in the English Revolution. There were the famous Putney debates, there were the levellers, the diggers, and so on. But they never quite achieved the same energy and dynamism. And the solution in Britain was eventually the restoration of the monarch and what do they call the Great Revolution? What do they call it?
The Glorious Revolution.
Sorry. And the maintenance of some kind of constitutional system with a monarchy in power, but in France it's the people who are supposed to be the rulers.
And well, look, the other thing is you talking there about 1968, this is much more within people's memory. I think the trouble is with a lot of British history, it's way gone, you know, that people just don't see, it's not simply within the memory of the elders of the tribe, if you want to talk to the younger people and explain it to them.
I mean, in 1968, you had the student movement, you had the countercultural movement internationally, but also the workers' movement in France. You see, the student movement is just a spark. It was a period of economic growth. That period of economic growth was coming to an end. As it came to an end, the question comes, where does society go? What's the future for the next generation? Will the middle class kids, particularly the university students, will they become managers and supervisors in the future? Or will their position be threatened? Will the middle class is entering, the youth of the middle class live better than the previous generation? And that type of crisis, economic, social, political, cultural crisis that follows from that, leads to a clash quite often in history, in which the students will start, and but it will actually reflect a much bigger, wider crisis in society about the constellation of class forces that will rule in the future. And that, I think, is what's happening now. That's what I think happened in 1968 as well. And it won't just be limited to France.
Well, I mean, you Marxists, I think, have got a bit of explaining to do. And I must admit, I'm, you know, very keen on a lot of Marxism analysis of history, particularly, you know, here with the takeover of the merchant classes taking over from the feudal system. I think he's done a fantastic amount of work. But don't you think that, you know, many people looking at these various revolutions, including the French, the Russian, etc., you see a different class taking over with similar sorts of repression, that the revolution is kind of lost in the process somehow?
Yes, I mean, that's got a long historical explanation, which, from my own point of view, is the areas where these revolutions occurred, where they were successful. I mean, you might argue about why they were successful in those countries as opposed to the wealthiest countries, but they did occur in very backward countries, and where you've got a big queue for food every morning, then some people would take more than others and protect their position. Even if they're officially, ostensibly declaring themselves in favor of communism, they'll still protect the privileges they acquire because they're necessary privileges for their existence. And they'll also conceal those privileges. And that gives rise to a new type of power, a new type. Some people call it a new class. Some people call it a bureaucracy. The question is not decisive as to how you label it, but what the actual material practice is. And Marxism is a materialist philosophy based on the idea that material forces shape the way the world is. So the degeneration of the Soviet Union, or the rise in China of a bureaucracy or an elite or a hierarchical structure of elite power, was an inevitability in those circumstances of making a revolution in a backward country. Now, whether that would be applicable in the most advanced capitalist countries, if you had a revolution, what type of regime of rule, what type of a power would be exercised by the people? Would they be able to prevent the rise of a new bureaucratic elite, is the central question for me as a Marxist. That, and it, I still believe that is possible, but obviously those who don't believe that, they've got legitimate arguments as to, you know, as to say, well, this is something endemic to man's nature. You know, that's what they'll basically say. I don't think that's true, but that's what the argument will be made against Marxism, if you like, and against the idea of a genuine democratic revolutionary overthrow of the system of capitalism, its replacement by something managed by the people for the people.
Well, I know you've been over in France recently. Can you just tell us what's your take on what's been going on over there over the, well, they says ostensibly the pension reforms, but it does seem to a certain extent the yellow jackets are back, you know, that they were kind of put out of action by COVID and mass arrests and fines and goodness knows what. But there's clearly a, you know, a movement under the surface bubbling up.
Yes, I think the, you know, the collisions that we had in Britain and elsewhere around the lockdown issues did not come to a head in quite the same way in France. There were big clashes, but they weren't quite as big as they were in Britain, for example. And I think that was because of the defeat, or not complete defeat, but the waning of the Yellow Jacket movement. And this is, I think, is a coming together of the sort of anti-lockdown Yellow Jacket movement, which was an you know, which the Western sort of pseudo left and liberals considered to be anti-climate crisis agenda type thing, because they're protecting petrol and all this sort of thing. And I think this was a genuine working class movement, the Yellow Jacket movement, and this is also a genuine working class movement, but it's reached out and it's connected in with the interests of the working class around the issue of the working at 62 or 64. And which is classical Marxism. I mean, you know, the class struggle, you know, who how much do you get out of a human being in their life? You know, how much do you squeeze out of them in surplus value? That's as classical a Marxist as you can possibly get. And this shows the battle that Marx talked about is still here and is the burning edge of global politics today. And so I think that combination came together in France, particularly last week and this week, and is going to roll. I mean, it may have ups and downs, but there isn't really a way out for Macron. Apart from, there was an interesting article in the Financial Times actually last week. Sometimes the Financial Times has good assessment from the point of view of the ruling class as to what they think should be done, what the way out is. You know, they have strategists of capital, just like they should have strategists of the labor movement. They don't really have many, but they should have. But and what they said in there was time for a sixth republic. So time to reformulate the entire constitutional structure of France to somehow facilitate the voice of the people. Now, what they suggested was that Macron should call for a new type of governance system based on, wait for it, citizens' assemblies, which, of course, ties in directly with some of this narrative we were talking about before, about the manipulation of movements. But at the same time, it would also be a contention ground which might capture some of the unrest within the population. So historically, the Paris Commune and also, say, 68 and most of the big movements of the working classes in France bring together democratic grassroots organizations of the syndicat, the sort of trade union, political trade unions they have in France, and the student movements and so on, and big assemblies, big rallies, meetings, and in the case of the Paris Commune, in an actual seizure of power by the masses over society and the self-administration of society by the working classes or by the urban population it was at the time. Now, there were elements of that in 68 as well. In the final days of the movement, the peasants came together, provided food, the workers were on strike, occupied the factories, they were all united together. You know, the potential appeared to be there for a revolutionary transformation of society. Now, the alternative, of course, from the point of view of the capitalist class, would be to create some institutional framework that would appear to be something like that, but actually be a completely neutered version of it. And that, I think, is what the Citizens' Assembly concept is, which the Extinction Rebellion people and a number of other people like that have put forward. Their idea is that instead of having democratic elected organs of power, elected by the people, recallable to them, where people receive, who are elected, receive a wage, mandated by the people, receive a wage no higher than a worker. Instead of this, they would try and create a system whereby a representative sample of the population, like an opinion poll people, would be gathered together in each area, and they would then be lobbied endlessly by big corporate interests to make them do their bidding. And I think that's the type of structure that the ruling elites around the world would like to create in the event of an urgent crisis. Of course, there is a danger that such an assembly would become a genuine democratic force. They used them, for example, in Ireland, I think, about the abortion vote a couple of years ago. And funnily enough, in China as well, they have got in the constitution in China a framework whereby workers are allowed to elect all managers in all, for example, in Shanghai, in all enterprises, but in all the major enterprises across the country, you have democratic elections. At least in theory, you've got democratic elections. In actual fact, it's a bureaucratic mechanism for strangling or suffocating genuine movements from below. But sometimes they have emerged into genuine organs of struggle. So these are battlegrounds, and these battlegrounds become, you know, they take on form as a movement develops. So I suspect that France, the movements will continue sporadically, with some really big movements and some smaller movements. The youth are extremely discontented, and there will be a continuous rumbling discontent. Macron will be forced either to resign or to make these type of concessions, and that will be a new battleground about what is democracy, you know, what is popular power, what is democracy.
I mean, what is interesting, looking over to Paris from London at the moment, is we've got ex-Goldman Sachs merchant bank Rishi Sunak looking at ex-Rothschild, NM Rothschild and Son merchant bank Macron. I mean, it does look, I mean, I think if it was back in the 1970s, we'd have been tearing our hair out. It looks as if we've got prime ministers from the top echelons of the financial, elite capitalism or finance capitalism.
Perfectly true. And I, of course, the peculiar thing is, if you look in the news today, it was reported last week in the FT, but in the news today, they confirmed it, that the British government has withdrawn its plans to extend the pension age by 2 years. And last week they made a little report and they said, well, it seems that they've looked at, the Tories have looked over at France and said, we don't want that. And so, funnily enough, the protest movement in France has not achieved its victory, but it's achieved a victory over here. So, and probably in a number of other countries as well. So it may only be a temporary victory, but it's a victory nevertheless. And but yes, the international elites, financial oligarchs, global financial institutions, all the WEF and all these institutional mechanisms they're creating for global dominance and using against the people, have got an extraordinary amount of power at the moment. At the same time, I suspect that they're in for a shock when movements develop from below that go beyond what's acceptable, you know, that would take to the streets and take on a form that it can easily bring down. I mean, bring down their power. I don't think, you see, Macron was one of their puppet, you know, figureheads. And I think his days are numbered. And I think that's representative of the mood in wider society. The same with Sturgeon, same with Jacinda Ardern. Okay, they fell over minor issues, but Macron, it won't be a minor issue. And Trudeau will probably fall. I don't know what the issue will be, but he'll fall as well. And so it's not, even though they try and cobble these people out and, you know, these puppets, I don't think the population really believe these people. I don't think they've really got mass support. Macron for a moment did, but I don't think the others do.
What about, I don't know if you're interested in commenting on Israel, because we've had ever since Christmas these demonstrations getting bigger and bigger over in Israel now, with even the former head of the Shin Bet, which is Israel's MI5, saying that the country's in danger of becoming a dictatorship. You've got amazing, I mean, I've never seen anything quite like it in Israel, with the population coming out onto the streets in their tens of thousands.
Yeah, I haven't followed in great detail, but I did notice that. And of course, some people complain, oh, well, they're not really on the side of the Palestinians. But often it's the case that people mobilize first and then suddenly begin to realize, well, they have some commonality with those people that have been slagging off forever. So I think that will be a key indicator of where things are going, to what degree this movement begins to make some people in Israel realize what has happened to the Palestinians all these years. But, you know, people in a trade or in a workplace or in a community or in a national group or religious group, they need to clash with the existing order to realize what their common interests are. So that comes back to the issue about sort of, you know, the internationalism of and the concepts of Marx in the first place. Whether you agree with them or not, it's still a valid mechanism to explain that type of dynamic.
So what do you make of this finance capitalism versus the people? It does seem as if we've got, I mean, they're calling it something quite sort of, you know, palatable, like the cost of living crisis. But actually what's going on is there's been a forced impoverishment of Europe. You know, some would say this is part of the deindustrialization, the enslavement of Europe in the American empire, as Europe is driven into this war with the Russians, and the United States is seeing itself as the sort of supplier of energy, supplier of arms, etc., to the conflict.
Yes, I think there are a lot of people who argue that Klaus Schwab and co. are commanding the trajectory of the world. And I think there is an element of that within the dystopian utilization of technology and the advance of key sectors, for example, pharma and AI and tech. On the other side, these are the trajectory is now inverted. I think the COVID pandemic was the peak of globalization. So this was as far as they're going to be able to go in terms of having the world on board to do their bidding. And then the war on Ukraine is the splintering. It's the consequence of that attempt to unify the entire world behind jabs and vaccine passports and segregation. That was the peculiarity of it. So the way in which the unification of the world under Schwab and co. appeared in its ultimate phase was the global splintering of the splintering of the world, you know, the European Union ending up as borders with PCR tests and lockdowns and God knows what, you know. And I think that's the inversion of that is taking place. This was the inversion of globalization, the splintering of the world and the division of the world into subsections. Now, the European Union, for example, van der Leyen was talking today, saying about, you know, we need to be wary of China, but the Spanish are out in China. The Germans are making deals with the Chinese. They're no doubt discussing Ukraine with the Chinese. And they've got a lot of interest in common with the Chinese. And if the Americans, there was an article in FT again today, quite a good article, discussing, well, what country can actually isolate itself? And it really, the United States is only the only country that can really just like, look, fuck them, let's sort them all. We're having nothing more to do with it. And only 25% exports, something dependent on exports. So they can easily deal with that. They've got their own oil and gas. They don't need to worry about the rest of the world if they don't want to. So there is an internal pressure. If Donald Trump or another Republican comes to power, then that pressure will increase. And they don't want it. A lot of Americans don't want to have anything to do with the war in Ukraine. And they don't care if Taiwan is Chinese or not Chinese. And so consequence of that is, I think, the splintering in the world will be exacerbated even more. The European Union will take a slightly different trajectory and have its own internal crises, a different trajectory to the Americans. And it's a tumultuous world, and it continue being a tumultuous world. And the Chinese will continue to grow because the internal structure of the Chinese economy is based on public ownership and planning. And that is a powerful mechanism for developing an economy, particularly in more backward countries like India and much of Africa, who will look to China for investment and for development, both as a model and for resources.
Well, look, let's finish on a look at the British opposition in politics, because we've had the announcement this week, finally, definitively, that Jeremy Corbyn will not even be allowed to stand as a Labour candidate. And that means there are rumblings in North London that actually, if he stands as an independent, he might win.
Yeah, it would have been nice if he was to stand as an independent against Keir Starmer himself in his seat. But anyway, in Islington North, he's almost certainly going to stand. I mean, there's not much option for him unless he was to declare he's going to stand for mayor of London or something like that. But I just don't think Jeremy's got much of a fight left in him. That's the truth of the matter. Unfortunately, he was encircled by a bunch of relatively incompetent individuals who were quite young. This was his team, if you like. I mean, I knew nearly all of them at the beginning. And then the group of Labour MPs who were dominated by John McDonnell, who is a vacillator. He's never been a consistent individual. He doesn't have a viewpoint that he will defend. He would go to parliamentary meetings, and then he would come out of the parliamentary meeting. I mean, I remember being in meetings with the Labour Representation Committee, and we were sitting in Paul Cullis' house in Parliament, due to have a meeting with John McDonnell. He would go into Parliament and chit-chat with all the Labour right-wingers who were plotting against him, thinking he was a manoeuvrer. I think he thought he was a little bit like Tony Benn, because Tony Benn was able, he was so long he was in the House of Commons, that everybody had to somehow look up to him. And he knew everybody, and he would literally pull Tory MPs aside and have a quick chat in their ear about something. He was a manoeuvrer who knew how to manoeuvre, whereas John McDonnell was completely out of his depth, and he thought he was being a clever manoeuvrer. And then he tried to get Jeremy to do the same type of things, and Jeremy was just against his best instincts to change his views, to come out with like slimy apologies and stuff like that. And so, you know, I was told by his inner team that Jeremy would like, you know, he would sleep till 10, 11 o'clock in the morning. He couldn't do anything basically till that time. I mean, officially he was at work awake, but he couldn't do anything. He couldn't follow anything. And then he'd be manoeuvred by a group of his team. And then, you know, I mean, the Brexit referendum, climate change, everything, he refused to engage on the issues. And he just went along with all this namby-pamby nonsense. And the only times he felt at home were campaigning. And that is his nature, you know. He was
described as a rock star, you know. And in fact, he was able to attract some massive crowds, do some terrific speeches. But he just wasn't. He didn't have the vocabulary to do the proper political manoeuvring up at Westminster, it seems to me. But what do you make? I mean, because it does seem with Starmer that you've just got the kind of the B team of the Tory party going there, and actually the only real opposition seems to be within the Tory party nowadays.
That's correct. And it's peculiar going back to the 1848 revolutions. And in those revolutions, though, the capitalist class had representatives who stood for ideals and believed in those ideals. Not all of them, but a significant number. They did betray, but there were still some who moved over further and realized that in order to achieve their own revolution and their own ideals, they needed to side with workers' movements and so on. So many of them were in alliance with people like Karl Marx and, you know, Bakunin and all these type of people. They fought together for a period of time. And I think there's an element of that coming back now, that sections of the conservative factions who believe in some in their ideals of capitalism and of democracy and capitalism, that some of them are actually orientating towards mass movements again, to realize that they have to appeal to people to get their ideas across, and also realizing they've made mistakes. For example, Andrew Bridgen, who now has come out ferociously against the vaccination program, perfectly correctly, and he's suddenly been totally ostracized by everyone on his side, or almost everyone on his side. And so I do think that, peculiar enough, sections of the Conservative Party are more likely to be, you could say, genuinely progressive minded. Even the word progressive is a bit grim now, a bit hair raising now. Genuinely represent interests that stand for the working classes. Some of that will happen, that it will be conservatives or an American republic. Don't forget, Abraham Lincoln was in communication with Karl Marx about, and wrote for the same newspaper, and was promoted by the same newspaper that Marx wrote for at the time in the 1850s and 60s. And the American Civil War was seen as a common cause of the of socialists and working class people around the world. So I think, you know, the genuine defenders of democracy, genuine defenders of free speech, genuine defenders of individual liberty and social rights, some of them will come from more conservative forces now. There's a complete splintering of existing politics, despite what Starmer imagines himself, like Macron and Trudeau. And so that era, I think, is over. And he won't. His political future is very limited. I mean, even if he gets elected, it's very limited. He's such a wooden man that I can't see him getting anywhere.
So, Heiko, how do people follow your work online, and can they come and see you at all? If so, when? At Speaker's Corner.
Yeah, every Sunday I've got two events. That one is the 11 o'clock for those who are interested in history and politics and Marxism. You don't have to be interested in Marxism per se for it, but history and politics is the Karl Marx Walking Tour. So that's marxwalks.com. In the afternoon, I'm at Speaker's Corner. That's about 11 o'clock at Piccadilly Circus. marxwalks.com. Speaker's Corner is in the afternoon about 3 o'clock, and this week we've got a defense of the women's right to speak against some crazy people who think everyone's a fascist if they're not supporting their, you know, pronoun obsessions. So 3 o'clock at Speaker's Corner, and then on Subject Act YouTube channel, Subject Access, I'm working with that channel. It's a blue channel, so it's a blue-coloured channel, Subject Access. You can find that on YouTube.
Okay, hi, Koku. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.